4.
You can also text us about your favorite roadside attractions. That's the question of the week this week. It could be a statue, historical marker, or maybe just a pretty spot to stop. What has caught your attention on the roadside? Tell us about it.
This is 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We operate translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Since 1976, Northern Community Radio has been telling the stories of the people and the land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Listen at KAXC.org or ask your smart speaker. Keep KAXC people powered into the future with your support now. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thanks for your support. Right now, we've got more news from National Public Radio's Morning Edition.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Russia says a Ukrainian drone attack on the city of Nizhnekamsk has left at least 12 people dead and dozens more wounded. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says the attack was part of a campaign by Kyiv to force Russian President Vladimir Putin to the negotiating table to try to end the war. Nizhnekamsk is more than 700 miles inside Russia's border with Ukraine and has two oil refineries and a petrochemical plant. The Pentagon is pushing U.S. defense contractors to speed up production of some key weapon systems amid concerns about depleted stockpiles as the war with Iran moves through its sixth month. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
In a statement, Pentagon spokesperson Sean Parnell confirmed the department made efforts in the past week to significantly speed up munitions production. He said that the U.S. is focused on acquiring more to provide, quote, the weapons our warfighters need at the pace the threat demands. But he also said the effort was not new, that it was part of a broader plan to modernize the department, one that began before the U.S. launched war in Iran in February. The administration has repeatedly denied reports that some missile stockpiles have been depleted in this war. Such weapons often take years to replenish. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump has named Will Scharf to be his new White House counsel. NPR's Franco Ordonez says Scharf will take over on September 1st.
Scharf takes over as the White House's top lawyer after overseeing the administrative work of the Oval Office as the White House staff secretary. He also led the National Capital Planning Commission, which approved the president's construction of the White House ballroom. He is perhaps best known, though, as the attorney who presents and explains executive orders to the president before he signs them during public Oval Office signings. The president wrote on social media that Scharf is tough, strong, and smart, and loves the country. Trump said David Warrington, the current White House counsel, is heading to the private sector. Warrington formerly served as a personal counsel and lawyer for Trump's 2024 campaign.
That's NPR's Franco Ordonez. There are widespread evacuations along China's east coast because of a typhoon. Here's NPR's Jennifer Pack.
The rain here has been nonstop. The typhoon also brought strong winds, triggering flood warnings across eastern China. At least a million people have been evacuated from their homes in high-risk areas. State broadcaster CCTV reports some train services were suspended and over 1,700 flights were canceled in multiple cities. China's National Meteorological Center has issued a red alert for torrential rains over the next couple of days.
That's NPR's Jennifer Pack reporting. This is NPR News from Washington. The water level at the Lake Mead Reservoir along the Arizona-Nevada border is at its lowest level on record. Officials say the water level dropped to 1,040 feet as of Friday amid an ongoing drought. The chairman of the Colorado River Board of California is among those sounding the alarm. J.B. Hamby says roughly 30 million people along the Colorado River basin are directly impacted by the risks to Lake Mead. Polling shows most Americans believe young adults in the U.S. have a harder time financially than their parents did at their age. NPR's Jennifer Ludden says many parents are helping to support their children well into adulthood.
When Mabel Lego and her husband retired to South Carolina this year, they made sure there was room for their 39-year-old son who lives with them. His job paid low wages and no benefits, and Lego says rents are way too high.
The young people have really been shafted big time.
In the pricey Seattle area, one of David Zuccaro's 30-something daughters moved back home to cut costs, and the other wants to.
When I look at the salaries these kids make, I'm like, how can you not live on this? But they can't.
The share of adults under 35 living with parents has shot up dramatically in the past two decades, and AARP finds most parents also provide financial support to grown children, needed or not, though many say they give even when it hurts their own budget. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
Stock futures are mostly higher this morning following Friday's day of gains on Wall Street. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Andrew Carnegie Foundation, formerly Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org.
It is 6 minutes after 8 o'clock. Thanks for listening to KAXC and the Monday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
Support comes from Watermark Art Center in Bemidji, featuring rotating exhibits including indigenous and regional artwork, plus classes and retail gallery. The center is accessible and open to all. More at watermarkartcenter.org.
And we thank the Grand Rapids Farmers Market for their support, celebrating 40 years of connecting local farmers and community. The Power of Produce, or POP Club, returns for the season. Kids ages 2 to 12 can sign up for a passport at the market. Each visit earns them a card to spend on fresh fruits, vegetables, or plants. The market is open Wednesdays and Saturdays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the intersection of Golf Course Road and Pacagama Avenue. More at grfarmersmarket.org.
The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 5 with host Paul Kivi, exploring the distinctly American art form. Tune in Sundays at 6 p.m. for Jazz on American Avenue.
Right now we're going to hear some new music from Fruit Bats. This is called Hummingbird Sage.
Picture this town 200 years ago. They say it used to snow. The creeks all filled with gold. Sounds of siren songs and the songs of swans. Egrets in their flocks, waiting in the aqueduct. I picture this town from 1,000 years ago, before it half burned down, before it was filled with ghosts. Back then the rain from the hills made the rivers rage, and the hummingbirds sit from the hummingbirds. Starts. The songs of unending age. I baked your ring in the cake, and I see your trembling hand pointing at the map. It's just nothing to believe in. Sometimes I picture this town in the days before we knew everyone we know. We held everything we hold before the coming of the dawn, before our coming of age, and the hummingbirds sit from the hummingbirds.
That's new music from Fruit Bats and the song called Hummingbird Sage here on the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
It's now time for our Bright Spot, a chance to highlight great things that local folks are doing. Joining us now are Andrea Patton and Carrie Berg. Just over a week ago, they both participated in the Hood 100, which is a 100-mile trail run over the course of 2 days on Mount Hood in Oregon. Good morning, Carrie and Andrea.
Hi. Good morning. Good
morning. So, wow, congratulations on taking it on. Tell us more about the Hood 100. I think one of you has done it before, correct?
Yeah, this is Andrea. I did it last year at the urging of a friend. And Carrie and I spend a lot of time running and skiing together. And so I put a bug in her ear about doing it, I don't know, over the winter?
Yeah, over maybe. The winter.
And she agreed. And so we gave it a shot this summer.
Yep, it was pretty fun.
Great.
I'm reading here that the climb is over 17,000 feet. What inspired you to run 100 miles up this mountain?
I think we started running kind of trail marathons, and then we did a 50 miler, and then it's sort of the next thing. Like, oh, let's do 100. Let's try it. Let's see. Because it seemed years ago inconceivable that we could even consider running 100 miles. But I think with each distance, you'd sort of think, oh, maybe I could try another one. Okay. And it was a race that wasn't at too high of elevation. And it's beautiful and is dry, good weather. So that's why we chose that one.
Okay. Yeah. How does the elevation affect you? Do you feel it as you climb?
Well, yeah, I mean, I purposefully like, oh yeah, elevation. And then I ask anyone what it was. I was like, I think I'm just going to pretend I'm fine. Okay. And I always said that if you are in really good shape and you don't train at elevation, that's your best tool to just be in good shape and be well prepared. So I feel like we were prepared as best we could coming from Minnesota and being grown-ups with families and jobs. We're just out here for fun, something new, enjoying it.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that, how when you're training, it's going to feel different than what you're actually, when you're there on a mountain.
We had secret training here in Minnesota. our last long training run, the humidity was like, I don't think it can be actually 100%, but I think it was. And the deer flies were 200%. And so once you took away the humidity and the deer flies and you just put us at a little bit of elevation, we were okay. Yeah. We're like, oh, this is nice.
You can handle it if after that.
Yeah.
This event goes over like 2 days, right? Is it 2 days of running, or how do you stop and rest, or how do you stay energized and fed and you know, hydrated?
Well, these are questions I asked Andrea last winter while we were skiing, and she was telling me I should do this. I was like, so you're saying you just run for 24 hours? And she's like, yeah, you get to wear a headlamp at night. And then there's the Grasshopper Fire near Mount Hood, and they switched the course to be like one 100-mile loop to be 7 smaller loops. So you actually went through the same 2 aid stations twice every 7 loops. Yep. Yeah.
Every 7 miles.
Yeah. Every 7 miles you got to do an aid station, so you could get water and more snacks, and you had like a little Tupperware of if you wanted your extra jacket. So we had lots of fill ups on snacks and fuel, and Andrea's family was there, and we had friends who were at the aid stations. The cutest part was Andrea's kids were spraying sunscreen all over us. That was their job.
I was going to ask about sunscreen, because imagine it's something you're going to need and if what you can carry with you. But that change in the course must have been a little beneficial, because I'm thinking if you're just going 100 miles straight, it's going to be harder for your support to be there, and for you to have the things you need. But when you're running by it again, it's like, oh yeah, now I can grab my jacket or whatever. So
yeah, at first when they changed the course the week before the race, we were pretty bummed. I think no one wants to really run a looped course for 100 miles, but it actually was amazing, because the loops were long enough that you didn't feel like you were just on a hamster wheel, but every 7 miles you got to see people and be re-energized. So yeah, they start the race at 5 in the morning, and you have 34 hours to run it. This year looked a little bit different because the weather changed, and all of the smoke from the fire that had been moving west to east and was okay in the middle of the night, that changed, and a bunch of ash and smoke rolled in, and it became like very hard to breathe. The air quality was pretty terrible. So they actually called off the race in the early morning hours. But it was really a pretty neat day until that happened.
Yeah. So Andrea, I heard you did finish in third place out of everybody, or just the women?
That was for the women.
Okay. And then Carrie, were you waylaid by the smoke and the ash?
Yeah, I got to mile 93 and the race was shut down. So while it was disappointing not to finish, the smoke was really making it hard to breathe and making it a bit nauseating after being awake for that long.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously disappointing, but they made the right call, because can you imagine being a race director and have someone have an asthma attack out there and it be on you? I think they were really disappointed after all the effort to course change, course correct, and pivot all week, sending out race emails of updates. But so at first I was disappointed, but then we went to for dinner that night, and we were seeing other people from the race hobbling along, and they were like, oh, we made it to mile 60. We made it to mile 50. And I was like, oh, well, maybe I didn't do that bad. And the exciting part was, as I was racing, you get to have a friend with you the second half. So through the night, you can have it's called a pacer. So I would have two friends. We're switching between, Andrea had her husband, and we had two friends with me. And I would say, how's Andrea doing? And they say, oh, she's like, she just finished. She got 10th place, and only 11 people finished. And there was over, I don't know, at least more than 200. At the start, there was 400 people, but then with the course change, maybe like 300 people. So I was just like feeling inspired and excited for my bestie to do so awesome.
For sure.
I was just thinking 93 miles is still blows me away. Amazing. That is impressive. Yeah.
Yeah. And is this the like the longest race you've ever attempted? Yeah.
Yeah. For me. Yeah.
Are there longer races out there? It seems like 100 miles.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
It's crazy.
I have my heart set on a race called the Cocodona 250, which is a 250-mile race over 5 days. It's a lottery to get in, and I was hopeful for this year, but did not get in, so I will keep trying. My name will be in the hat again.
It all just seems superhuman to me.
It does. So if you would have asked me 5 years ago, would I ever run 100 miles, I would have said I'd be broken and like curled up on the side of the trail. There's no way possible. And then you just bite off a little bit more and a little bit more. And pretty soon these distances that we're just running as training runs are just a normal Saturday run where you run 30 miles and that feels ordinary.
Well, very amazing and congratulations to you both. Anything else you want to mention about the Hood 100?
I'd say my favorite part was because I just didn't know what to expect, and I could ask all my friends who've done it a million questions and on every run, Andrew, what about this? But I just didn't know. I just was like, well, I guess I won't know what it's really like to like do it. And then I was doing it. And I think my favorite part was like running with headlamps in the night with a friend, trying to figure out like, what can I eat to keep going that doesn't, you know, seem gross after eating.
Yeah. Cause you don't want to get bogged down. Right.
Yeah. Yes. And then just seeing all the other people out there, cause it was a loop course. You saw so many people all the time. You don't know what lap people are on and at the aid stations and just hearing the funny stories and meeting the people along the way, who are like, yeah, my stomach's sore too. Yeah. My toe feels weird too. And you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, trail running is a really tight community when you're out there racing. Yeah. It's really fun.
Fantastic. Well, that is Andrea Patton and Carrie Berg. We will have this story at KAXE.org in the next few days. And Bright Spot is made possible with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Congratulations again, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's the Monday Morning Show on KAXE.
But I can't stop looking down the road.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Martinez. Warnings about low T, low testosterone, are all over social media. And the military plans to start screening service members for their hormone levels. NPR's Will Stone reports on who really needs testosterone therapy.
A few times, Jamin Brombot suspected he might have low testosterone. So he got his numbers checked. Turned out they were normal.
It was more my sleep and stress and everything else that was causing these symptoms. So
Brombot is a urologist at Orlando Health in Florida, so he knows what to look for. Depressed mood, fatigue, reduced libido, weight gain, trouble concentrating, all of these can be signs.
Most of the questions are so vague, so it can also be very situational.
That's why guidelines recommend that men get tested twice and evaluated by a clinician to consider all the possible causes. Unfortunately, Brombot says that's not always happening.
Testosterone has gotten a bad rap because you can just walk into these clinics, get testosterone. They don't even do all the testing. They don't do the follow-up.
In fact, one study published in 2022 sent secret shoppers to online clinics. It found most were ready to prescribe, even though the patient in question had normal levels. Social media is full of low T content. It's often framed as a crisis of masculinity, even for younger men. Some clinics tap into these fears and pitch testosterone for optimization, longevity, confidence, focus, and strength.
The goal of testosterone therapy isn't peak performance. It's not some drug to promise this fountain of youth.
Dr. Helen Burney is director of male sexual and reproductive medicine at Indiana University.
It is restoring normal physiology in men who have a true deficiency.
She says testosterone isn't just about sexual health either.
It's really, really important for our overall health, for muscle, for bone, for energy, for moods.
The underlying causes for testosterone deficiency vary. There are some relatively rare medical conditions, for example, related to genetics. For most men, it's not that. Testosterone declines with age, but Bernie says in younger and middle-aged men, it's related to more than aging. Obesity, diabetes, sleep apnea, and other medical conditions can all contribute. And while you can try to correct those issues first, that's not always realistic.
Think of the 60-year-old guy who's got low testosterone. He's tired. He's overweight. You know, he feels terrible. And now I'm telling him, go to the gym, man. Go work out. Well, it's kind of like pushing a huge boulder up and up Battle Hill, right?
So she says sometimes a patient can start testosterone therapy while making these other lifestyle changes too. There are downsides. It suppresses sperm production and over time can lead to permanent infertility. About a decade ago, concerns about heart attack and stroke led drug makers to launch a big safety study. That ultimately did not find an increased risk of major cardiovascular events, though it did find some other harms like fractures. Dr. Steven Nissen is a cardiologist at the Cleveland Clinic who led that trial. He points out they used a gel, not injectables, and made sure testosterone levels did not go above the upper limit of normal.
We used the drug in a very specific way, and we have a very reasonable answer. But I would not feel good if our study resulted in the unrestrained use of testosterone in ways that we didn't study.
It's a message that can be tough to get across in a culture brimming with high T content. Will Stone, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com.
This is NPR News.
This is KAXE and the Monday Morning Show. My name is Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
Good morning. We received support from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information available at mndeerhunters.com.
We also received support from the Minnesota State Fair. It's the Great Minnesota Get-Together, 12 days of food, entertainment, rides, animals, and family fun, starting Thursday, August 27th through Monday, September 7th. More at mnstatefair.org.
Our question of the week, we're asking about your favorite roadside attraction. It could be a statue, historical marker, or maybe just a pretty spot to stop. Tell us about it at 218-326-1234. You can send us a text.
Right now, it is time for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. Incarceration can put people into the system for years and destabilize their families. This spring, KAXE distributed a survey aimed at reaching Indigenous people who were willing to share their or their family's experiences with the criminal justice system. Jennifer Combo was one of those survey respondents and agreed to share her family's story in a more in-depth interview. Combo is 37 and her partner, Jason Gorno, is 42. Gorno is an enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. These lands are near Belcourt, North Dakota. Combo is a Turtle Mountain Band descendant. The couple have been through the highs and lows of incarceration and addiction while together and also while separated. Both now live at East Grand Forks with their blended family. As a toddler, Combo's eldest son was diagnosed with a liver disease, which he described as challenging for a young mother while also attending college in Moorhead.
Alcohol, and then I was introduced to meth. I thought that was the answer, to be able to do all the things, go to school and take care of him, and until it wasn't. And it took everything from me eventually.
Shortly after his successful liver transplant at age 10, Combo's son was removed from her custody to live with another relative.
I really had nothing to live for and ended up homeless, living out of my car, and getting my first felony for stealing my mom's checkbook.
Combo says she bounced between sobriety and addiction until she and Gorno were arrested on the same day almost 5 years ago. During the raid in October 2021, law enforcement officers stopped Gorno and found large quantities of narcotics. Officers secured a warrant for their shared residence, which also led to Combo's arrest. Gorno was facing 10 years in prison due to his extensive criminal history.
Yes, it was pretty wild, but mostly the things I went to jail for was driving without a license, not be able to pass a UA for weed, you know, back then. Some of the harder drugs back then, too. Living on the res, you start drugs early. Back in my era, you did.
Gorno said his childhood was marked by the traumatic death of his father at the age of 8 and a stint in juvenile prison that followed running with a tough crowd. Like many KAXE survey respondents who were impacted by incarceration, Gorno especially experienced challenges securing housing after his early release from prison. After a successful completion of a diversionary boot camp, Gorno said he tried his hardest to maintain the conditions of his parole, but finding housing with his record was challenging. Eventually, Gorno found an apartment that accepted him, but it wasn't a place that felt like home.
The place I took is just like a slum place known for easy renting, so I got in there and put up with it like I was never there, though. I had to settle there. I couldn't live where I wanted to live.
Combo and Gorno say they didn't have strong cultural connections as youth.
Raised in a time and a family, and you just keep going. You just keep going no matter what. And if that means you have to drink or do drugs to keep going, then that is what was done.
She says even though she and Gorno had a rough start with their parenting journey due to their addictions, they aim to do better for their younger children.
We were able to, you know, do what needed to be done through community resources and support and investment, reconnection to cultural identity, and just a desire to make it work and give them what we didn't have and we couldn't give our older children.
Gorno says the greatest joy in his life these days is his children. He works in Crookston as a mechanic. He is nearing the end of his parole.
The numbers were against me, right? I'm supposed to be already getting high at this time and back in jail and going back to prison and not finishing my parole, but I was kind of consciously aware about all these numbers toward me, so I keep it like a low-profile life.
Combo graduated early from probation, became a homeowner earlier this year, and has launched a campaign for a Minnesota House seat. She now works to help others navigate similar challenges.
I refused to become a victim to the system again, and I showed up in community. I showed up everywhere outside of my comfort zone to not allow the things that happened to happen again.
Read more in-depth coverage on this story and other parts of the Overrepresented Undercounted series on KAXE.org. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
You can find that story at KAXE.org, along with lots of other local news stories and conversations. and the Up North Report. You'll hear the latest edition today at 5:30 during All Things Considered here on KAXZ. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
Minnesota's primary election is August 11, tomorrow, and early voting is open now. The KAXZ News team has put together a 2026 primary election guide. You can learn more about candidates running to represent you at kaxz.org/election guide. New this year, printable versions. You can help by sharing election info with your friends and neighbors.
And remember, coming up at 9 o'clock, Heidi Holton, your host for Headwaters, your source for great music and the request line theme. In light of tomorrow's primary election, Heidi wants to hear your songs that are about making choices, the freedoms that you have. Text in 218-326-1234. Right now, we continue with Morning Edition from National Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Culver City, California. Nearly 30 years after Tupac Shakur was killed, a former gang member goes on trial today for his murder. Shakur got into a fight in the lobby of the Las Vegas MGM Grand Hotel in 1996. A few hours later, he was hit in a drive-by shooting and died 6 days later. Since then, there have been all sorts of theories about who did it. Reporter Steve Futterman is in Las Vegas for the trial. Steve, so take us back to 1996. Remind us of those circumstances.
Yeah, well, much of this, officials say, stemmed from a feud between a pair of rival gangs. Tupac Shakur was here in Las Vegas attending a Mike Tyson fight at the MGM Grand. As he was leaving the hotel with his entourage, he spotted Orlando Anderson in the lobby. Shakur believed Anderson had been involved in an earlier attack on a member of Death Row Records, which was Shakur's label. In the MGM security video, Shakur is seen punching Anderson. Others get involved before it's broken up. The prosecution believes the fatal shooting of Shakur a couple hours later was retaliation for that. Prosecutors say the man on trial, Dwayne Davis, orchestrated the killing and provided the gun. He was also allegedly in the vehicle that drove up next to Shakur when he was shot. Now, police knew much of this almost from the start, but they never had enough evidence to bring charges.
Okay, so there are charges now. So what has changed?
Well, in 2019, Dwayne Davis wrote a memoir, and in that book, he talked about being in the vehicle, supplying the weapon. Well, you can imagine what Las Vegas police thought when they saw that. They reopened the investigation. Still, it took 4 years to bring charges. The key part of the prosecution's case against Davis is going to be what he said. Here's Lori Levinson. She's a former federal prosecutor who's not involved in this case.
The prosecutors don't really have any direct evidence in this case. They don't have physical evidence or even the eyewitnesses. What they have are Davis's own words, and that's what they plan to use to try to convict him in this case.
Now, also in 2008, Davis did tell law enforcement what he knew about the killing. Davis and his attorneys say it was supposed to be confidential. Well, it was until Davis talked about it in his book and interviews. When that happened, the court ruled he violated the confidentiality agreement and it will be used in court.
All right. So what kind of a case will the defense put on?
The defense strategy seems to be twofold. It admits that Davis may have said these things, but argues that he was fabricating and embellishing to help increase sales of his book and embellishing for law enforcement to avoid drug charges. On top of that, Davis claims he was not even here in Vegas the night of the killing. And the defense is expected to call witnesses who will try to back that up.
All right, Steve, 30 years later, I mean, Tupac Shakur is still larger than life in the world of hip hop.
Well, he is definitely an icon. Many hip-hop stars of today view him as a major influence. Yesterday, I spoke to a young man here in Las Vegas, Tim Dunk. He was born the year Shakur died, and he's a huge fan.
He wasn't afraid to show how he felt. He wasn't afraid to use his everyday life and struggles to convey it to his fans through his music.
Now, jury selection should take a week. It begins today. Testimony is expected to last around a month, and the trial will be televised.
All right, that's Steve Futterman in Las Vegas. Steve, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
The federal agency in charge of the nation's airspace says it's time for a reboot. The Federal Aviation Administration is turning to technology, including artificial intelligence, to make flying more efficient. NPR's Joel Rose reports on how airlines are already using similar tools.
Alaska Airlines operates roughly 1,500 flights a day.
most of them guided by a team of dispatchers on the sixth floor of an office building near the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport, known as the Hub.
This one is destined for San Diego. The origin is Chicago O'Hare.
Alec Mead is a manager in Alaska's Network Operations Center, basically the airline's brain. It's a big open room full of flat-screen monitors. Dispatchers sit surrounded by as many as five screens, showing them real-time air traffic, weather, wind patterns, and more. It's a lot to process. But these days, Mead says the dispatchers are getting some help from a software tool called Flyways AI.
It ingests all that information from the National Airspace System, and it really kind of puts that all together in a nice little package for the dispatcher to kind of look at, take some options, maybe play around with some different ideas, and then pick the most efficient and the safest route.
Alaska was the first airline to start using Flyways back in 2021 to do things that would be challenging, if not impossible, for a human dispatcher. Captain Brett Payton directs Alaska's Network Operations Center.
It doesn't decide the route or waypoints that a dispatcher uses to get an airplane from A to B, but it does help provide suggestions that might be more efficient. That's where Flyways is really excelling for us.
Alaska says it's saving thousands of hours in the air and roughly 1 million gallons of fuel per year because of Flyways. So how does it work? Basically, by crunching all of that data, air traffic, wind, weather, to anticipate what is going to happen, giving the dispatcher more insight.
It's actually a really fundamental change, massive behavior change.
That's Philip Buckendorf, the co-founder and CEO of Airspace Intelligence, the company that built Flyways, speaking on the podcast Crossing the Valley last year. Buckendorf says his company worked closely with Alaska to build Flyways from the ground up to help dispatchers adjust to this new way of working.
One of the hardest things is we're dealing with users that have basically made decisions against like static displays for like 10, 20 years of their career. And so now they basically make a decision against the predictive picture.
Federal regulators are betting that predictive analytics can make the entire U.S. airspace work better, too.
I think we've got a real opportunity to do something transformational with AI.
That's the head of the Federal Aviation Administration, Brian Bedford, speaking at an industry conference in May. Bedford says the U.S. airspace is safe today because air traffic controllers make sure planes are separated from each other at every stage of their journey. But Bedford says the current system is not as efficient as it could be.
What we're seeing is a system that is woefully unorganized. We don't have in any of our facilities the ability to see the entire national airspace picture in a unified way.
Bedford says predictive analytics can help prevent bottlenecks and congestion before they happen with relatively small adjustments to schedules and routes. The FAA is so convinced that it announced a major contract with Airspace Intelligence in June for nearly $900 million to modernize the nation's airspace. The FAA says the goal is to help air traffic controllers, not replace them. But skeptics wonder if this technology can scale up from helping airline dispatchers to optimizing the entire U.S. airspace, which is the busiest and most complex in the world. Brett Payton at Alaska Airlines says dispatchers there were skeptical, too.
It took a while for us to convince the dispatch group that it is what we say it is, which is a decision-making aid and not a tool that's going to run rogue and make weird decisions for the dispatcher. And it happened relatively quickly once dispatchers saw the true results that were pretty immediate.
Payton says he gets the skepticism about AI in aviation. But if it's done well, he says, with the right limits, it can work. Joel Rose, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is KAXC and the Monday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
The Northern Minnesota Robotics Conference invites you to celebrate the opening of the new North Star Center this Wednesday at the Beltrami County Fairgrounds. Joining us now is Jesse Frost, a robotics coach from Cass Lake Bina High School, and he's been involved in this project.
Good morning, Jesse. You are on mute. There we go.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. So tell us, first of all, about the Northern Minnesota Robotics Conference.
Sure. So I'll back up a little bit. We're all part of what's called FIRST Robotics, FRC. There's about 200 teams in the state and about 4,000 teams worldwide. And up here, we know it's very rural. There's a lot of distance between schools. A lot of our coaches and folks that work with our students are just teachers. And we're in this competition competing against the best of the best from around the world. And we struggled in the early years of trying to be competitive. So what we did is we, in 2017, we formed our nonprofit. It's the Northern Minnesota Robotics Conference. So I can talk to a coach that's 50 miles down the road or 200 miles down the road, and I can get what they know and they can get what I know, and we can raise all of us up better. So we started the nonprofit, and we've been working with high school students and providing them opportunities in STEM for the last 10 years now, almost.
Great. So you've got this new center. It's called the North Star Center. It's at the Beltrami County Fairgrounds. So STAR is an acronym. Tell us more about what that stands for and why you wanted this center.
Sure. STAR is Science, Technology, Automation, and Robotics. So if you think the swim team or the football team or the basketball team at your local school, they all have a place to practice. They have a gym or a pool or a field that they can go play on. With robotics, that is unfortunately not the case. So the students that are at our schools are trying to practice in their classroom or in the hallway after school or places like that. And you just can't get the full feel for what this challenge is, what the game is. So we, with a bunch of our sponsors and with the help of the Beltrami County Fairgrounds, we have this facility now. It has a full field set up. It's about the size of a basketball court, and it changes every year. So the kids can come from all over the region and bring their machines and test them on a real field so they know how it's going to really react when they get to a major competition.
Now, if any of the listeners out there are like me, when they think robotics competition, they're thinking these things that we see on the internet where the two robots are battling it out with all sorts of things swinging all over the place. I'm sure that's not the case here, but what is the competitions like for y'all?
Sure, yeah, and we get that. Yeah, this is not fighting robots. Flamethrowers and spinning saw blades are probably not good for high school kids.
Nope.
All right, it's dangerous enough as it is. But the machines we build, they're about 150 pounds, so they're industrial-sized robots. They're driven on wheels. The speed's 12 to 15 miles an hour, so they're zippy things. And you do have to be careful, but it's not the object is not to destroy the other people. The object is to work collaboratively with an assigned group, and you're against another assigned group, and that kind of rotates through the competition. And every year it's a different task that has to be performed. And we in the robotics world kind of see it as either a shooting game where you shoot an object into some sort of goal, or a pick and place game where you have to pick something up and set it somewhere. And depending on how well you do those things, you earn points and you progress through the competition.
That sounds really fun. We're talking with Jesse Frost. He is a robotics coach from Cass Lake Buena High School and involved with the Northern Minnesota Robotics Conference. What do you think draws young people to robotics?
Oh, there's so many things, and we get such a wide variety amongst our teams. Kids that are, a lot of it is kids that might not fit into the athlete niche, but that's not 100% true. But we get a lot of those kids because it's a competitive sport. It's a varsity sport in Minnesota. You can earn a letter, same as you can in football or baseball or anything else. But it has that competitive aspect, plus it uses all the skills that they're learning in their daily classes, whether it be math, computer science stuff. I'm more on the manufacturing side, so we do how to run a CNC machine, how to precisely measure things, you know, engineering theory when we go through the process of building these things every year. And it gets a wide variety of students. We have students that are, this is their only thing, and that's really what they do. And we have students that are on the football team and on the track team. And then this time of year, they're on the, or the winter time of year is when our season is mostly going, that they're on the robotics team. So
this new North Star Center, it's located within the Beltrami County Fairgrounds, correct?
Yeah.
And how was that connection made? Did you work with their Ag Association, or how did that all come together?
Sure. I'll rewind a little bit. We've been trying to get a facility for our kids, our region, for years. And just vacant building space and stuff like that is hard to come by up here. So we tried to do some stuff with a few of the schools, and they weren't real interested in having a facility on their campus. So we reached out to the fair, and they've been hugely supportive. And agriculture nowadays is going to automation. You have drones that are flying over fields and doing crop surveys and even spraying in some cases. You have combines that are running autonomously out there and harvesting crops. So it's kind of the future of what agriculture is going to be, is what our kids are learning while they're in the program. So we approached them. They thought it was a great idea. They're very innovative up here in Bemidji at the county fair. They see it's not just chickens and cows that need to be at the fair. It needs to be something more. So we have a lease with them, and the space is provided, and we provided the material and the funding for the building that's there. We have actually two. We have an office space and then a 60 by 90, 16 foot sidewall building where the field is held. And yeah, it's been a great relationship, and they're excited to have us, and we're excited to have the opportunity to be able to use their space. So.
And do the students actually like manufacture and build the robots here in this space, or how does the space get used on a regular basis?
Sure. Well, when we were building the building, we had a partner contractor that was our general, and then the students did a lot of stuff. I mean, we framed up the walls. We did a lot of sweat equity to say into that. And we've had kids travel for hundreds of miles to come down for the weekend to put up the interior paneling on the building and help out with the steel siding and stuff like that. But the space is now set up to some degree. We're planning on some expansions of what we have currently, but to do some construction there. But realistically, in our geographic area, they're so spread out that you can't load kids in a van after school and go down there and actually start working and creating too much. I mean, a lot of the building is still done within our school buildings respectively, but we have some equipment that was donated. So we have milling machines and lathes and some CNC stuff there that if you break something while you're there and trying to do some practice stuff, that can be fixed and recreated. So it's a multi-purpose facility, practice and some construction space.
Yeah. You mentioned CNC equipment. What is that?
That's CNC stands for computer numerical control. That was my background before I got into teaching. I've been teaching for 20 years now, but prior to that I was a machinist. So teaching those kids those skills that, all right, you design a part on the computer, and then you bring it over to this machine and you plug it in basically, and it with some skills there, it'll cut out whatever you design. So you need this weird shaped triangular bracket to go on this thing to hold the arm up. The kids are learning that on the computer. They can bring it over and plug it in, and we can cut that out for them out of whatever material that they need for their robot.
That sounds like something I would have loved in high school.
I hear that all the time. Yeah. Me too.
Anything else?
I've been teaching for 20 years. What us old folks call a shop teacher. It's technology education now. But as far as a real world engineering based platform for students to learn on, I mean, we have budgets, and the kids got to go out and get money to, because these are not cheap things. Our regional competitions cost thousands and thousands of dollars to attend. We attend stuff in the state and outside the state. So we have a PR crew, and we have people that are working on electrical stuff, and people that are working on the software that make these things actually move. Otherwise, they're just kind of a big paperweight. real world engineering, we find out our new challenge in January. We compete at the end of February or beginning of March. So we have 7 weeks to design this 150-pound machine to go compete against the best people in the world. And we compete against teams from Israel, Japan, everywhere. Having that, all those things combined, really gives a student a taste of what engineering and manufacturing really is. And it's led a lot of my kids down a career path that they might not have expected. Like, we've had kids that have come into the program and you ask them what their plans are, and maybe it's healthcare or education or not sure. And by the time they leave the program after 3 or 4 or 5 years, they've decided. They know what they want to do. And that's the most rewarding part as a longtime teacher, is to see that light come on for those kids.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. That is Jesse Frost, a robotics coach and past president of the Northern Minnesota Robotics Conference. The grand opening of the new North Star Center is this Wednesday, 2:00 at the Beltrami County Fairgrounds. Thanks so much for joining us, Jesse.
Yeah, I hope to see everybody there. It's gonna be fun. Come and see the kids and see what we're up to.
All right, thanks. It's the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. Listening to new music from Luke Winslow King, Don't Worry Your Mind, here on the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy.
We received support from Edward Jones Financial Advisor Christina Clark, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
We also thank UPM Blandin Paper, a provider of renewable material solutions with a focus on sustainability and innovation. Additional information at upm.com.
Today's weather, mostly sunny with increasing clouds, highs 78 to 82, light northwest wind. Tonight, mostly cloudy, lows 54 to 59. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 70s to low 80s, chance of showers overnight with lows in the upper 50s. And Wednesday, it looks like a slight chance of showers, partly sunny, highs 75 to 79.
Support comes from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley and Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart